Have you ever wanted to have a conversation with a professional working in your field of interest? Are you intrigued about how they got started in their career and what it's really like in their line of work? Welcome to the Five Questions podcast, initiated by the academic heads at Santa Sophia College. You'll be surprised by how much you can discover with just five questions. I'm Sarah O'Keefe, the academic head of arts at Santa Sophia College. I'm a third year resident of the college. Currently, I'm earning a combined degree in media and communications and film studies at the University of Sydney. Today, I'm sitting down with Julie Baird. Julie has been the director of the Newcastle Museum since April 2018. She's held a variety of roles throughout her career, which Julie is also going to discuss with me during our time together. So, without further ado, Julie, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with me. So, speaking of which, what does a normal day at work look like for you?
See, this is why I like my role, because there is no such thing as a normal day at work. The breadth of my role encompasses everything from emergency shooting on trying to bring dinosaurs in during COVID by freight from China to the minutiae of signing people's timesheets. So really the museum director's role is all about multiple different hands in multiple different pies, I think.
That's a brilliant way of putting it. So how have things changed during COVID? So I'm interested in what's happening at the moment.
Well, it's been really interesting for us. So we've gone through two lockdowns at the museum where it's literally, okay, shut the doors, send everyone home. Luckily with museum work, most people perceive that if you didn't have a visitor in a museum, there'd be nothing to do. But there's so much work, probably about 60% of my staff work back of house. So they don't actually have anything to do with visitors at all. So we've had to transition and train some workers from visitor-facing roles into things like digitizing of collections, into social media engagement. So we've done lots of online engagement, and then all of a sudden we're back again. And so now it's all about trying to make sure that staff feel supported because, you know, we're throwing the doors open again. And, you know, we're in a Awabakal country up here in Newcastle, and we've got a lower vaccination rate than the state. So, you know, my staff are trying to work out how to maintain safety and being welcoming to people, but at the same time, keeping themselves safe. So, you know, I think we're a brave bunch up here, and we're ready for the adventure, but certainly we've twice had exhibitions that we've put on the floor after great planning and years of work, only to have to close after a couple of weeks open due to COVID restrictions. So that's probably been the hardest thing, is you work on this long-term plan for a really long time and you're right into it, and then boom, doors shut, and you're like, oh no, no one can see it for a while. So that's been our challenge, I think.
Oh, dear. But you mentioned at the same time that you've been doing some online engagement work. What does that actually look like?
Well, I guess we've been doing a variety of different things. We've found that people like a bit of intellectual stimulation. So we've been doing online workshops, things like we've had scientists talk about environmental crisis and mental health and how you cope with that. So you have this small sort of online webinars. And then at the same time, we've done variety shows where we bring in musicians to do covers of other bands and do how you make a cocktail course. So it's been everything. And then we also have child-based ones. So we've had kids doing science at home with their families, and then videotaping it and sharing the science and talking about what they're actually exploring in their own backyards. We're one of the last of the all-rounders. We do science, we do history, and we do community, and we try and balance them all at once.
You're kidding. I mean, is there anything you don't do?
Pretty much not. And it's been funny, like we just the day before we closed on this lockdown, we planted a living exhibition. So we took trees and plants that were mentioned inside on labels. So things that were quite significant in our area, like red cedar or, you know, white banksia, and talking about things that were traditionally used for Warramina wobbegal tool making. And then we planted living examples in the backyard. And so people can learn about the object, learn about the history, learn about the plant all at once. But that was 2 days before we closed. So I've spent all of lockdown worrying about my grass tree plants and whether they were going to survive. But luckily, in our outdoor area is a huge community of skateboarders. So the skateboarding boys have taken care of my Permian coal era garden bed and grass trees during lockdown. So it's you never know where in this line of work your support is going to come from.
Oh, that's so heartwarming. You really are like this community hub that I had no idea until like 20 seconds ago. This is so insightful. Wow.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, history, you know, people think of history as this sort of unchanging past. And really, for me, like I started my university career as an English drama double major because I was really into stories and characters and people. And then I did a few, luckily my university forced you to do courses in areas outside of your specialization. So I had to do a course in geology and microbiology as part of my humanities degree. And one of the things that I had to do as an English drama double major is a history course. And then I got so into these stories about real people that were more fantastical than the fiction that I was studying and interpreting in English and drama that I segued. So I was halfway through a degree and then I went, yep, I'm changing, and started from scratch as a historian. And I guess for me, history is all about who are we and where are we going? And that whole idea that, you know, a lot of people say the past is a foreign country. I actually think that we have to see it as we're migrants from the past and we're heading to the future. So museums are all about living in three different planes of time and trying to ascribe significance to it and identity. So we're about who's Newcastle, the museum will tell you.
That's a perfect segue into the next question, because you kind of talked about your university career and how you switched mid-degree. So how was it that you became museum director at the Newcastle Museum, starting from the beginning of your career?
So it's actually quite a convoluted one. So cool. when I was in high school, when I was a senior in high school, I wasn't actually that interested in history. I had one particular teacher in high school that, because we were so confrontational, he was very, very different and had very different values and beliefs than me. And so we had these great debates in high school. And, you know, when you're a teenager and you think you know everything, and bless him, he was very good with me. And he raised that sort of level of interest. And so, but I didn't really think of it as a career. I come from a really science-based family. So my father is a veterinary medicine academic, formerly from University of Sydney and now working in Canada. My mom had left school early, but she had gone back and done a sociology degree. My sister is my big sister is a doctor, and my little sister was an agricultural scientist. So I'm the black sheep, because I was the artsy one. And when I entered university with that real idea that I was going to be sitting in coffee shops, drinking long blacks and having really deep intellectual discussions, that's what I wanted from university, not a career. And so I started down that English path, and really for me, it was quite a, it was almost a earth-shaking moment. And I had married quite young. So I got married at 21. So when I was doing university, I was going to university in Canada as well. So I went to University of Guelph, and I was going with a small child. So I changed into history, and I'm sure my parents were horrified. Like, you know, what are you going to do with a history degree? And when I was going through, I started volunteering at the local museum. And really it was like half a morning a week just to get me sort of out of the house and sort of see something different. And I discovered that I had a passion for it, because you're utilizing great ideas, right? So big, lots of research, huge amounts of time. And like a journalist, you synthesize it down. So someone who doesn't think they care anything about, the history of World War I comes and is engaged through objects. And so I think that museum work is often most similar to journalism, because it's all about interpretation for the masses and how you take that. So I started sort of volunteering and kind of got into it and found that I had a bit of a knack for it. And then I decided to take every crazy, challenging job that came my way. So I took all these jobs that were risky. So I worked with a museum collection that was next door to a high security women's prison in Canada. And so the women were trying to be deinstitutionalized. So they needed work to raise money to buy food. And no one wanted to work with these prisoners. So the museum started bringing objects into the museum, and the women would go through the boxes of objects and help with the collection records and that kind of thing. And the museum was terrified of the prisoners, and the prisoners were terrified of the museum objects. And I was 24 and had no training and was stuck in the middle. And everybody said, oh, don't worry, you'll just have drug dealers. And when I sat down in my room I got out all my scissors and I got out my needles to put labels on things and brought out baby bonnets, which is very bad for a women's prison because most of them are mothers missing their children. Everyone was a murderer in the room. And I'm like, oh my God. So I took this job that was innovative and risky, and I put myself out there. And then I just continued to do that. So every time I took a job, I would always take the most difficult job. So at 29, I became the curator of the National Motor Museum in South Australia. As a young female without any interest in automotive history at all. And then at the time I was the only one in the world that was a female as a curator in there. And so what I did was I always made a hard road for myself, but it means that I developed these skills and a CV that showed that I could cope. I never had easy roles, and I made them my own. And I think that that's how I became a museum director, because I constantly challenged myself. I took risks, and I've always been outspoken in what I believe. And I think that that makes you stand out. You get respect because, it's a podcast. People can't see me, but I'm covered in tattoos. I have green hair, and I am a senior leader in a local government. And so, you know, there has to be, I can't do my job without being me. And I've never been afraid of that. And I think that that makes you stand out a bit. The Minister of Arts knows that I'm the one with the pink hair kind of thing. And I think that being brave and listening and taking risks has probably been the best thing I've done in my career.
It's awesome to know that, like, irrespective of, like, how true to yourself you are, how you dress, how you dye your hair, like, there's still opportunities for you in, like, the upper echelons of industry. You don't have to compromise.
And it was interesting. I had a boss once, and he had asked his mentor for advice. He said, you know, I want to be a museum director. Can you give me some advice to move ahead in my field? And the advice that the mentor gave was always be yourself and always be slightly different, because corporate sponsors and politicians and all those people like to think that there is these crazy arts people out there in the world and they're slightly askew, and you can give them money and they'll do wonderful things in your name that you're afraid to do. And so, you know, yes, when you buy a suit so you can fit into that corporate environment, but make sure it's a little bit different, because, you know, they love the idea that the arts community is this creative place. And look, you know, I did try at one point when I was younger to fit in. I covered up my tattoos so people didn't see, and I tried, and I think I was a much less effective worker. I think that you know, certainly the ability to be oneself, and there's so many kinds of careers in museums, so, you know, not one type of person goes in a museum. So I've got some very pedantic, beautifully structured, process-driven people that do finance and administration. I've got completely mechanical, kinesthetic people who are good at building and can create structures out of nothing. I've got people who like to sit in a office and chair rock and chin stroke and think great thoughts and write, and all those spices in the spice rack we need, and you never know what you're going to get. My admin officer is this very beautiful young woman who's very detail orientated. She's great at making sure that she sort of follows along behind me, crossing my T's and dotting my I's and all that stuff. And she is a Aboriginal singer with dreadlocks down to her bum and covered in tattoos, but she's incredibly good at process. And I think that in this place, we have created an environment that we have everything from ex-priests, we have people in their 60s, we have our youngest staff member is 19, and we all respect that the value of us is in our difference, and that by allowing people to be who they are, it's a much more productive, safe and inclusive museum where visitors come and they see themselves reflected. You know, Diane at the front desk is in a wheelchair, so she's really good at reflecting, you know, people with mobility issues. I have vision impairment, so I always make sure I read the labels, because if I can't see them, then no one can. And so I guess it's using ourselves as our strength.
Oh, you are the queen of analogies. I realize this is a side note, but there's so many things that you just said that I was just thinking to myself, I'm going to nick that actually.
Go like, for it, babe.
Thank you. Spices of the spice rack. I mean, even comparing, this was a couple minutes ago, but comparing journalism to museum curation, I'm studying journalism and that had never occurred to me, and you're completely right. And I just had a bit of an epiphany. I wish I had my camera on so you could have seen it.
And look, and that's why the reason there's only two people that I drop everything for when they call. One is Aboriginal community, because, you know, in the past museums have had very poor relationships with Aboriginal community. So if someone is on the phone and they're Aboriginal, everyone else can go away. And the other people are media. And we've done work with everyone. Like, we had an article, A New Idea, Christmas edition, which I thought was the best thing ever. Like, yeah. I'm going, oh my God, you know, in doctors' surgeries for the next 10 years, they'll be reading about our earthquake exhibition. And we've just got an article coming out in Arts Australia, which is a very high-end journal, and everyone in between. But that idea of storytelling, that's what we do. We take other people's passions and make them palatable.
There's so many potential answers you could give me here, but if you could condense it down to one, what do you find most rewarding about your job?
Relationships. the most rewarding thing about my job, and when I analyze it, and when I go home at the end of the day feeling good, is when I have been able to create with someone else, when I've been able to do good to support someone else. So for me, often museum work is almost like a social work. That relationship building, so I can have an opening and I can know the 19-year-old who's putting on shows somewhere at the same time as I know the executive that's been the major sponsor for it, at the same time as I know the person who's written the labels or the person who comes along and sweeps up. It's all about relationship building, and that's how we manage to we've just passed 10 years on the site. We've moved the museum and 10 years on the new site, and we've had almost 1.5 million visitors through, with a staff of predominantly 9.8, but it's just gone up to 12, open almost every day of the year. The only way we can do it is because I don't know everything, but I know everyone else. And so I know that, okay, I want to do some work on Aboriginal weaving. So I know that I pick up the phone and I give Sheree a ring, and then it's almost like this web. And so someone will phone me and say, oh, I'm looking to do something on BHP history with trains. Who do I call? Oh, you call this person. So a lot of my job is about interconnecting people and creating through positive relationships and respectful relationships. That's the thing that makes me wake up in the morning and go, well, hey, I'm off to work.
Wow. I mean, it never ends, truly. Like, networking is so important to, it looks like, every job I'm ever going to have for the rest of my life, and certainly in the museum sector. That's why I'm at the University of Sydney.
Yeah, and for me, it's all about listening. So you know, I've found people come to Newcastle after success somewhere else, and as I did, and they come and they go, this is how you do it. Instead, I came and I went, I'm going to hear how you do it, and I'm going to listen. So I kept my mouth shut and I give other people a voice, and that has been probably the best thing that I've done, because now people think I'm from here, and they're more likely to participate. So it's almost an Aboriginal way of working. So when you meet someone new in Newcastle, you say who you are, how you related. Oh, I'm Julie, I'm from the museum, or I'm Julie, I know your friend, they play in a band I've seen, or that kind of thing. So you set your nation, and then you follow the rules, and you don't put yourself above other people. You don't do shame job. And then if that works, then you're interconnected and everything shares and everything's between a community. If you do the wrong thing, they chuck you out and you have to earn your way back in. So when I first came to Newcastle, I didn't get it. I couldn't understand the city and people weren't helping me. And then I went, everyone is traditionally Aboriginal, treat everyone like they're Aboriginal and you'll be fine. And it's worked. So I think Newcastle, despite, you know, the sort of cleansing and covering up of Aboriginal past, I think it works like an Aboriginal nation.
Again, that's brilliant advice. And you convinced me. I genuinely thought you were from Newcastle. I just assumed.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? It's working still.
Yeah, no, I'm Western Sydney to a year living around the world with an academic dad. In Netherlands and the States and that kind of stuff. And then I moved to Canada in first form or grade 7, and then lived there till I was 29, came back to Adelaide, which I'd never been to, but my sister was there with 2 kids and a Canadian husband, and then moved to Newcastle in 2002 to undertake the move. Oh. And so I'm an outsider everywhere I am. And that's beautiful in a museum or in a journalistic thing, because you have the ability to observe because you're not part of it. And so I always think that becoming too much of belonging too much is dangerous in museums and journalism, because you can't see from an outsider's point of view. And if you have to interpret to an outsider, then that's hard because you're no longer an outsider. Then now you're all about spark plugs or you're all about something.
Yeah, that had never occurred to me that you'd have to balance kind of subjectivity and objectivity, especially in your line of work.
Yeah, because you're creating significance. So if you put something in a museum, you can put any crap in a case with a nice light on it and a label, and people believe it's important. So museum professionals are incredibly powerful, and no one understands that. They just think we're the nice guys with the glue guns and a butter churn. But we have this incredible power because we ascribe significance. So we say we're going to collect this into the collection. We're going to keep it for 100, 200 years. We're going to put money into preserving it because it's really important. And we're going to put it on a wall and we're going to tell you how important it is. And people believe that. So, we just did an exhibition called One Times Four. And that shook that whole idea on its head. So we put an individual object, four different ways of looking at it. We didn't say what was the most important. We didn't say anything. We also put a song with it. We put some video links. And then we said, you get to choose what you want to see. You get to decide what's important. And rather than the curator saying, this is the most important brick in Australia for this reason, we said, you can look at this brick as a discussion of colonial architecture, or you can look at this brick as a convict trade, or you can look at this brick about Aboriginal massacres. And we ended up winning the National Museums Award last year. We did that exhibition for $17,500 and our four staff that worked on it. And we beat, WA Museum, who'd spent over $1.5 million on their permanent exhibition.
No.
And now we're touring it, and it's also available online. So if people want to see the different kind of work and how museums manipulate people and how museums make you think a certain thing, go to 1x4.com.au and you can go through that whole exhibition. And you can do it from the comfort of your home. And there's links to University of Newcastle, Australian Museum, those kind of things for really in-depth stuff. Or you can listen to covers of Daryl Braithwaite's Horses other silly and groovy songs. So please, if you want to know how museums work, that's a really fun way to do it.
So as a museum director, how would you ascribe significance to Daryl Braithwaite's Horses?
Daryl Braithwaite's Horses. So funnily enough, the object that works to is a racing saddle. So the racing saddle tells four stories. So one of the stories is about professional racing in Australia. One of them is about a Warramai man, Merv Maynard, who was the jockey on that saddle. And the other one relates to politics because Merv Maynard's father was one of the original Aboriginal people who was protesting in 1938 when Australia was doing it was really sort of the birth of Aboriginal rights movement in Australia. And the other one is about sports and about First Nation sporting greats. And I'm looking for a horse-related object, a song to it. And I'm thinking, I'm going to put Daryl Braithwaite's Horses in, but I'm going to do a contemporary cover just to mess with people and to put a bit of humour in things. Like, we take ourselves so seriously. And we think that everyone's watching us. Like, they're not. We can have some fun with it. We can have some fun with our visitors and they can enjoy it. And it also promotes contemporary musicians and hopefully gets a bit more press out there for them.
Stay tuned for the next episode of Five Questions to hear the second half of Julie's interview.